Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains August 15th through the 18th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Hey, everybody. Welcome into Redacted. I'm Clayton Morris.
I'm Natalie Morris.
And on this show, we try to connect the dots in this crazy clown world that we're all living in right now. We've got a very busy show for you on this Monday. We're glad to be back after a week off with our crazy kids, rested, read up, and... It's a crazy world out there.
Yes, it is. We're so glad to be back with you. Whenever the kids are off, we try to take off. We have news that broke over our break that we're going to get to later, but it's a busy news week. We're so glad that you've joined us again.
Yeah, so we're going to look at Julian Assange, of course, what's going on right now in the UK. This could be the tipping point week for Julian Assange and his extradition to the United States. We're also going to look at the U.S. border invasion, but not in the way that you think. Actually, the northern border connecting to Canada. This is a story that hasn't gotten really any attention at all, but that number has now jumped up 700%.
We're going to look at the censorship. I can't say that. Censorship industrial conflicts. That doesn't roll off the tongue. Maybe we have to just use an initialism for it.
Yeah.
Censorship industrial complex. Sick.
It's a massive industrial complex of right. Censorship.
That would be an acronym because you can pronounce it.
That's even preventing you from speaking.
Sick.
Yeah.
Sick. Or kick. I don't know. Okay, we'll talk about that some other time. We have a lot of news to get to. Redacted starts right now.
Sick.
Monday, it's time for the news. Everybody works on Monday, although if you're off for President's Day, we hope it was a nice, restful one. We did not take off. We took off last week, so we're back at it. I'm Natalie Morris. This is Clayton Morris. This is the show where we cover the stories the mainstream media largely ignores, or we look past the spin that they put on the news, see if we can find the truth.
Neil Oliver is going to be joining us here in a moment to talk about the Julian Assange case out of the UK. Of course, a very big story. And as a free speech advocates here on this show and power of journalism, the importance of free speech and journalism, this is a monumental story. The future of journalism, the future of free speech. What does it mean for Julian Assange to be extradited to the United States, where his wife, Stella Assange, says he will die if he leaves the UK and goes to the United States? So we'll get to that story in a big way in just a moment. But first, we want to thank our show sponsor for tonight's show, which is our friends over at Stamps.com. And, you know, postage rates just increased again. Yes, they did. Luckily, Stamps.com has the best discounts in the industry with rates you can't find anywhere else, like up to 89% off the U.S. Postal Service and UPS. Plus, Stamps.com automatically tells you that your cheapest and fastest shipping options, so you don't have to navigate all the different carriers. They'll do it all right at home, where you can print everything right in your house, print it out, slap it on a box. You don't need to wait in the line at the post office or any other government entity, and you can ship it right to who you need to. And guess what? Right now, if you go to stamps.com/redacted, you'll get a 4-week free trial plus free postage. And, of course, you'll also get a digital postage scale. That's right. You'll get a 4-week free trial plus free postage and a digital postage scale. Just go to stamps.com/redacted. Stamps.com/redacted.
Julian Assange will die if he loses his appeal for extradition this week and is sent to the United States. That's what his wife and lawyer, Stella Assange, said about the appeal that starts this week.
The situation right now with Julian is so critical, he could be bundled into a plane within days of the decision. The decision could come down this very week. Once he's in U.S. custody, he's going to be put in the deepest, darkest hole in the U.S. prison system, and it will be much harder for him to be freed. He cannot survive more time in prison. He needs to be released, and I think we've heard enough is enough for 3 years now. Let's be clear. Julian needs to be released from prison, and he needs to be released now.
What this is the right for a full appeal. If he's denied, he could be on a plane to the United States within days. If it is granted, they will presumably send him back to prison, and he will wait out another right for a full appeal within 8 to 10 months. Neil Oliver joins me to discuss this. He's a historian and author, and he speaks loud and proud on GB News about the anti-war movement for which Julian Assange is being punished. I'm so glad to speak to you for many reasons. One, I'm a big fan of your work. Also, because your country is holding the football, so to speak, on the Assange case, my country is sort of the shark with its mouth open. So what do you make of the Assange case, and what do you think it means for all of us?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm delighted to have some time with you. I'm horrified by the Julian Assange story. It's been a shaming period of time, all the way from that time in the Ecuadorian embassy, and then the time in Belmarsh, and the fact that he's being so relentlessly pursued for extradition is just. It's shaming and shameful, and it is continually thrown into sharp relief, I think, by the hypocrisy elsewhere, and as has happened again with all of the excitement and all of the condemnation that's coming from the West around Navalny's death in prison, and people talking about how terrible it is when opposition is held in prison and when attempts are made to crush opposition and so on and so on, when always looming there, like our conscience laid bare and made real, is Julian Assange, who has been so abused and so mistreated for essentially publishing true facts. And revealing truths that are inconvenient to the US, to the West. And he's always, he's looming like that, as I say, like a manifestation of our guilty conscience, that he is being treated in the way that he has been treated. I'm appalled. And, I hold my hands up and say that I know that I haven't done enough. I haven't said enough and done enough and been strident enough in protest about what has happened to him and what continues to happen to him, and the fact that he's now reaching another of these moments in his life where, as you say, it's probably life or death, is frightening.
But this is not conspiracy theory, people who speak out for Julian Assange. I've never seen somebody say, oh, you're a, right-wing extremist because you speak for Julian Assange. It's almost incontrovertible to speak for this man. What do you think the British people think about what this says about the UK doing the bidding of the US? Because that seems clear to me. Is it clear to your kinsmen?
Well, obviously there are factions and there are different groups within the UK. It's not as though there's a British opinion or a British voice, but I can confidently say that there are millions of people who are either quietly appalled by what has happened to Julian Assange, and fewer people, I suppose, within those ranks that are loudly, outspokenly appalled by what's happening to Julian Assange. I think it's always when you've followed a story for such a long time, it always comes as a jolt when you realise that there are still, however, people who are only vaguely aware of what's going on. That almost sounds inconceivable, but it's still the case. Although it has so much of it has played out here, and he's in prison in London, there are still many people that aren't really across what has happened to him. But there is a steadily growing portion of the population that are aware that we in the UK, we in Britain have been a lapdog of the United States for a very long time. There used to be talk of the special relationship. But maybe at one point, when I was a child or earlier, maybe there was a special relationship or a relationship that could be classed as special and that it was some kind of mutually respecting. But I think increasingly there are many people here in Great Britain that accept that we are just doing the bidding of. And I'm not sure how full-throated the defence of Julian Assange is when it comes to, you know, the establishment here. And I have I don't know what you think, but I have a very bad feeling about what events might play out in the next short period of time.
Yes. So I'm trying to read the tea leaves. I came across this tweet today where someone said, well, if Rishi Sunak had the balls to let Julian Assange go, his ratings would jump massively. Rishi Sunak could use a ratings boost. Do you think that there are politicians in the UK who may play it thus? And is there an advantage to doing that?
Well, that's definitely, it would be definitely true to say that Rishi Sunak needs all the positive press he can garner, and he needs popular support. Maybe, I mean, we're all very dubious about exactly what the support of the press actually means nowadays, but I think he would garner popular support by doing the right thing by Julian Assange. And I accept that it's possible, but I'll be very impressed if Rishi Sunak is prepared to be seen to fly in the face of the United States of America and do that right thing and do right by Julian Assange.
Right. I mean, the judge could presumably say, okay, you are going to get another appeal. And in the meantime, there is no reason for you to be in prison during that appeal. We will put you on house arrest and you can be with your children. That's a possibility. I'm putting that, I don't know, I guess we could play odds if you want to play a little game that Jack can play with us. I'm going to put that at 45%. Do you want to ring in?
It's so difficult to read it because part of what has happened to me during the last 3 or 4 years is I used to be much more confident about my ability to read situations than I am now. I have been so surprised, so shocked, so knocked sideways by a world turned upside down and inside out that if I'd been asked to read the tea leaves or make predictions about a story like this 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I would have had the gall and the temerity to be confident about making a prediction. Now nothing would surprise me.
Right.
I simply would not be surprised by anything that happens because my experience over this period has just undermined my confidence in my own abilities to call what I think is going to happen next. I've been surprised and let down and shocked so many times over the last 4 years that has become what I expect. So although it's possible, obviously there's everything to play for, anything might happen in the Assange story, but I do not have the confidence anymore to make predictions.
Well, one of the things that you talk about a lot is the freedom to discuss things that are anti-narrative. And the way that we are shut down from discussing these things is through the label of conspiracy theorist. In January, you had this video went quite viral for talking about conspiracy theorists. It was brilliant. I'm going to play a little clip.
To be a conspiracy theorist is to have been right all along, despite the efforts of the paid-for liars. And it's also to be demonstrably well ahead of the gullible, still believing in smoke and mirrors. Conspiracy theorist was first used by the CIA to shut down those who doubted the official line about the murder of John F. Kennedy, that fishy old tale about a lone shooter and a magic bullet, and then that lone shooter being shot by another lone shooter before he could talk. That was in the 1960s, and from then, the label conspiracy theorist worked for decades as the means to make thinking people too scared to speak when they smelt a rat. Let 2024 be the year of clearing out the rubbish, the trash, the long overdue year when the past or sell-by date labels, conspiracy theorists among them, are cast into the dustbin of history.
So the labels continue to evolve. You know, Putin apologist, COVID denier, climate denier. Now we're called a new denier, anti-vaxxer. So is this something that is a way to erode our freedoms, to be critical of our government? And also personally, how do you take it? Because I don't take it well.
I think it has been effective up until relatively recent times. I think the effectiveness of seeking to dismiss questioning voices, dissenting voices, always as conspiracy theorists, or always to, if you've got questions about Ukraine, you know, to be a Putin apologist, to have questions about what ideology is being forced on the youngest of our children at schools, and you become transphobic automatically. If you have questions about the globalization and the influence of bankers, then you're automatically anti-Semitic. And I think it's becoming a worn out tune. I think it's becoming the case increasingly that these are badges of honor almost. And I think unless and until you've been through the process of being, you know, shamed or ridiculed or defamed in that way, then you're not really in the fight.
Right.
And if you have battle scars, well, fair play to you. You know, you and I were communicating offline before this conversation, you know, and I said there is that famous quote from Churchill who said, if you've made an enemy, well done, because it means you've stood up for something in your life. And I am now glad to stand shoulder to shoulder with those elsewhere who are routinely dismissed in this way. And conspiracy theorist is increasingly, you know, is just descriptive of someone who saw it first, an early adopter of the truth, as it were. And the time between being dismissed as a conspiracy theorist and being shown to have been right all along is collapsing. It's almost instantaneous. It's a bit like the first time you get a punch in the face, or the first time you get a physical blow. It's shocking, and in addition to the pain of the blow, it's the surprise. The more times you're called conspiracy theorist or Putin apologist or whatever, it's still uncomfortable, but the shock has gone. The surprise has gone. And I am, if I had my time again, you know, sometimes, my mum or might ask me from time to time, you know, if you had your time again, would you operate differently? You know, would you say the things that you said, you know, knowing what you know now? Absolutely, 100%. I wouldn't change a thing. Like you, I'm sure the process, the experience of standing up and asking questions and saying things has meant that I've lost a lot of relationships. A lot of people have turned away from me. But I've also had that void filled by a whole new cast of characters with whom I am increasingly pleased and proud to stand. So I think it's fine. I think it's all right to be under attack. You know, if you're taking flak, you're over the target, is another old adage, and it's demonstrably true.
Yeah, but one of my sort of New Year's resolutions is to have camaraderie with people like you, because it gets lonely sometimes, I will admit, and I don't take it quite as well all of the time. Sometimes I don't mind, and then sometimes it hits differently. And so it helps to have other voices like this, and you think, well, that sounds exceedingly reasonable when that person says it. So I feel a little bit better.
Don't get me wrong. Every punch hurts the same as every punch. It's not that it doesn't hurt. I've had the time to adapt and acclimatize. And it almost, what if the time comes when I'm not, you know, a periodically trend on Twitter, and you know, and I'm periodically the focus of news stories that are picked up by all the mainstream newspaper titles here in the UK. But if that stops happening, I'll get the sense that I've drifted off of target.
Right.
It's a timely reminder. Every time you get accused of conspiracy theory or anything else, it's a reminder that you're still there, that you must still be in the right area. You know, I think it's crucial that people realise that, you know, that tendency to that temptation to keep your head down and to keep quiet, even though you know the truth and you know the right things that ought to be said, but people have to be prepared to take the responsibility to speak out, whether they have a platform or whether it's just in relation to friends and family and workmates, because groups go wrong, governments go wrong, communities go wrong, nation states go wrong. They drift from the, you know, they drift from the true path. And it's people within the group, it's their responsibility to fix it. You know, and you have to be prepared to step outside, you know, step beyond the pale, step out of the group and look back in and be prepared to be targeted as an enemy of the state, as a traitor, as a conspiracy theorist, because it's from that position that you're able to take up the job of pulling the group, helping, sharing the onerous responsibility of pulling the group back onto the right path. And it's uncomfortable. People, there's always a natural human tendency for people to want a quiet life. And also people want to be seen as nice. People want to be seen as nice. They get along, they rub along, they don't cause trouble. That is actually the antithesis of the right thing. If you stand mutely by while things that you know to be wrong are done and committed, then you are serving the wrong. And people have to get used to the discomfort of saying no and standing up and saying what you're proposing to do or what you are doing is wrong. And the fact that it makes you uncomfortable means it's the right thing. That's what you, when it's uncomfortable and it makes you, you know, lift your shoulders in expectation of a blow, you know, from who knows where, that's when you know you're doing the right thing.
Right. And, you know, I think that's why the Julian Assange case is so important, because so little of what he showed us was conspiracy theory. It was war crimes perpetuated by the US and the UK right in front of our very faces. There was no way to explain it away with conspiracy, so they had to persecute him personally because there was. And so one of the things you say in this video is the best way to protect yourself is to be a conspiracy theorist. Because then at least when you're told something, you question it. And then you don't swallow things that may hurt you, take medicines that may hurt you, and that kind of thing. I want to get you out of here on one more question. Of all of the narratives that we talked about here, the right to question vaccines and pandemics, truths, gender, ideology, the war in Russia, which is the thing that you are maybe most worried about or passionate about? Well, let's put Julian Assange aside right now.
Well, even with Julian Assange in our sights at the moment, as what we're talking about, the thing I'm most worried about anyway is war. I cannot believe that we here in the UK, we've got senior military figures talking about the necessity for a citizen army. You know, retiring General Patrick Sanders, the army chief, has said that we need a citizen army. Now, that just transports me in my head back to the pictures of Kitchener and Your Country Needs You that were the run-up to 1915 and then 1916 and the catastrophe, the apocalyptic events of the first day of the Battle of the Somme, when that citizen army stepped out and 60,000 casualties were racked up by the British Army on that first day, 19,000 of them dead. That was a citizen army. And at least over 100 years ago, people had the excuse of not knowing what industrialised warfare would look like and what it would do and the toll that it would take. But we do know that. We have been learning, well, we were supposed to have been learning that lesson ever since. And that kind of saber rattling and that kind of talk of, following the beating drum and getting young people in particular. I've got two sons and the very thought that somebody out with my control, you know, would even contemplate putting them into uniform and taking them to a front like is harvesting so many souls in Ukraine at the moment, fills me with absolute, you know, ungilded horror that this is where we are again. When everyone knows that, you know, that a citizen army thus deployed, you know, would be vaporized, you know, before it reached any front line, and it all falls into what I've been talking about in other contexts for a long time now, about the anti-human agenda. I think the powers that be, those that claim to lead us, treat us with contempt. and they treat human life with contempt. Everything, the net zero agenda, is anti-human.
Yes.
So many of these objectives that have come to the fore in the last 4 years, mandated medical procedures, lockdowns, you know, talk of all the rest of it, the 15-minute cities, the social credit scores, the central bank digital currencies, they're anti-human. And just when you thought it couldn't get more anti-human, they actually raise the spectre of coming for our young people and putting them literally and physically into harm's way. So nothing has focused my attention and nothing has got me more determined to stand up and speak out than talk of war, forever war.
Yes. Well, for your children and for mine, I'm glad to know you now. I've been following your work for a long time. This is the first time we've spoken, and I was excited about it. I want to tell our audience you can follow Neil Oliver. He's at The Coast Guy on X, and he has, I believe it's weekly segments, right, on GB News.
Yes, every Saturday night I'm on GB News. I also have my own podcast, my own channel, you know, through the week. So I put stuff out on YouTube and so on, and people can catch up with, keep up with me there. But okay. It's been lovely to talk to you, Natalie. I've been so excited by the prospect of talking to you, and I hope we can do it again.
Yes, please. You're welcome on Redacted anytime.
Thanks, Neil. And it's so many people in our audience say, Neil, finally on Redacted.
Yeah.
So welcome.
That was a real treat for us, too. We're excited to have a kindred spirit.
And one of the most important stories of our time, I mean, right now, literally discussing extraditing Julian Assange to the United States to be in a supermax prison for 125 years.
Yeah.
Like, that's his fate in the United States right now.
Now, something, you know, that I'm kind of tossing around as we talk about whether or not it'd be useful for the United States to drop charges, whether or not it'd be useful for the UK to step in and save him.
Yeah.
Australia has all of a sudden caught up in the fact that one of their own has been tortured. Because they want to sell this Navalny poisoning story so badly, do they need to juxtapose it with Julian Assange? Like, hey, Russia, you should have let him go. Look what we're doing to Julian Assange. We're doing the right thing. You didn't do the right thing with Navalny, which is a big pack of steaming lies we're going to get to later in the show today, all the Navalny lies. But would the timing be that it's fortuitous for Julian Assange?
Yeah, maybe they'll actually use this. It'll be somehow a tool that they'll be using. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
That wouldn't fit the narrative of everything the U.S. does is righteous. I mean, that's just really how we constantly act, is that everything we do is righteous. So it's righteous that we're going after Julian Assange, but Russia, no, that was wrong what they did. You know, that's just how the narrative plays out.
Well, no, we could pretend we all of a sudden are righteous. I mean, even though he was really pursued during the Obama years, you know, it would be a way for Joe Biden to sort of separate him from the legacy of Obama. And again, they can spin it. One of the things that the takeaways from the Putin interview with Tucker Carlson was you cannot win a war of propaganda with the United States. So they could use it to their advantage. Now, I guess I'm kind of, I'm biased in this area that I'm like, well, if it helps Julian Assange, just do it.
Right. You want to use
I don't care.
You want to use a bullshit Navalny story, like make up stuff about him, that he's some sort of a hero and not a CIA asset. Then great. Then fine. Use that story. He's no longer with us. And get Julian Assange out of prison. Like, I agree with you on that. However, Joe Biden is a demented fool, and he's not running the United States government. So he's got a deep state behind him that's literally keeping Julian Assange in prison, and that's what they want. I mean, Mike Pompeo wanted to assassinate him. So that's the goal of the United States, is to kill Julian Assange.
Right. And so, again, one of the things we talked about was, could this be something that Rishi Sunak desperately needs in order to gain some points for himself? Is there anybody who could use this for self-serving interest? Do it. At this point, I don't like when people act in a self-serving way, but I'm just hoping for any Hail Mary support.
We'll even slow clap for you. We'll even slow clap for you.
Yep.
You know, like, we'll just show our appreciation. Just freaking do it. I don't care why, just do it.
Yeah. I mean, Vivek Ramaswamy said that he would absolutely pardon him if he were president of the United States. If he becomes part of a Trump administration in the future, maybe he'd push influence there to get him pardoned. I mean, who knows? Anyway, fingers crossed.
It's like that tweet said, though, if he just had some balls, he could just let him out. He doesn't even have to be the president of the United States to do that. He's not in the United States. Julian Assange is in the UK.
Right.
Right.
You just let him out. Say, nope, he's good.
Yeah, and something Sorry. That, again, I just keep coming back to is that the former president of Ecuador was arrested just 2 years ago in England and allowed to await his extradition trial in a luxury mansion right, next to Buckingham Palace.
Yeah.
So, Buckingham. Did I just say that?
I think you said Buckingham, but that's a good
that's
mix.
That's not a place.
Yeah, that sounds British, though. Like, you, if you said Buckingham, people are like, yeah, that sounds British.
Yes, but, Kensington yeah. Ham or something like that.
West Kensington Ham.
Anyway, you get the point.
Right.
So anyhow, how come Julian Assange has had to wait in a high security prison when other people, other blokes who are awaiting extradition get to be free while they await those trials? So there is, I don't know, could the judge have a conscience and say, okay, I will grant you this appeal.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, why don't you go home and be with your boys who you've never actually lived with ever?
It's awful. Absolute tragedy. So hopefully we'll see some big movement here for Julian Assange. Our fingers crossed on that. We're praying for him. Absolutely the case. And for his family. We've got more news to get to here on your Monday night. We are live. Good to see all of you guys. Let us know where you're joining us from. Oh, yeah. Here it says Loddenham. Graffiti Forensics in our chat says Londonham.
Londonham.
I like blimey, Jack Plugman says. Yes. So let us know where you're joining us from around the world. We are live on this Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern time. Good to see the thousands of you on Rumble and YouTube all over the place. We're going to talk coming up here about the U.S. border invasion and a remarkable story at the northern border. Yes, the United States border with Canada. We're going to tell you about the massive surge of migrants coming across the northern border and why specifically in about 70% of the cases, one particular area of the United States. This is a story that I find absolutely fascinating. It hasn't gotten media attention really at all. And we're also going to look at the censorship industrial complex with a remarkable interview this weekend with Tucker Carlson did with Mike Benz, formerly of the State Department. We have a lot to say about that, and we're going to dive deeply into some of the mechanics of how all of this is actually working to censor you, keeping your voices silenced on social media.
All right. But first, we're going to get to other things. Benny Hill in the chat says, this show ain't live. Yeah, it is. I just proved it to you by saying your name.
Benny Hill? Benny yeah. Hill's here? Dun, dun,
dun. I don't know who that is, but don't tell me I'm not live.
Well, but while Benny Hill's running around chasing women.
We're live right now. I'm telling you. Okay, but first we want to tell you about our friends over at Moomoo. Do you find yourself with a substantial amount of cash that's currently idle and not generating any returns? Well, then maybe it's time you explore the trading app that we have started using recently named Moomoo. It offers an impressive 5.1 APY plus an extra 3% APY for your uninvested cash. You have to know that 8.1 APY is 17 times the national average savings account interest rate, and there's no minimum deposit limit for cash sweeps. This is one of the highest interest rates that I know of. That's why we love Moomoo, and it stands out by offering zero commissions and no platform fees for stocks, options, and ETFs. It's packed with powerful market analysis features absolutely free. For example, now the U.S. market is having earnings seasons. You can get financial data, analyst ratings, earnings calendars, and more, all free to use. So the 6.8% margin rate is one of the lowest that you'll find. You can tap into pro-level tools and information absolutely free. So sign up by using our link below, grab up to 15 stocks, and park your idle funds on Moomoo for a sweet 5.1% APY plus 3% APY extra. Earn up to $5,000 in cash rewards when you transfer assets to Moomoo. Once again, that's $5,000 extra cash. So go to redacted.inc/Moomoo.
All right, let's talk about what's happening at the U.S. border. Something we've been warning about here on this show now, I think for, months, of course, we've been talking about the rise of illegal immigrants pouring across the southern border, but not the northern border, of course. The southern border has gotten all of the attention, but Canada, no. The U.S.-Canadian border is seeing a massive influx of border crossings over the past few months. In 2022 alone, we saw a 200% increase in crossings into Canada, from Canada into the United States, 200% increase over 2021 numbers. Now that number is up 700%. Listen.
Let's go to the U.S. northern border with Canada, where U.S. officials report a growing number of migrants crossing into the country. One sector of the tri-state area says there has been a 743% increase in illegal border crossings in the last year and a half. NBC's Julia Ainslie is reporting live from the northern U.S. border. Julia, good morning. What are you hearing there?
Well, Jose, you don't usually see me in a climate like this. I'm usually talking to you from the southern border, but I'm up here in Plattsburgh, New York, where state police took us up to the northern border with Canada, showed us around, and they say that even though the numbers are nothing like what they're seeing at the southern border, they've gone up from between October and January from 150 migrants to over 1,500 just in this area alone.
Yeah, just in this area alone. And so...
In the snow.
They're traipsing right through the snow. It doesn't matter. Snow, sun, leaves on the trees. It doesn't matter. It's coming at all times. And so now what's going on here? How are they skipping over the United States in order to illegally enter the United States? Like coming from Mexico, hopping over the United States in order to enter into the United States. Like it really kind of confounds the brain. Well, it turns out if you have a little bit of money, you avoid all the problems that you get coming into the United States through the southern borders, through Arizona, through Texas. Instead, fly into Ottawa, fly into Toronto, fly into Montreal, and then scurry down across the massive 5,000-mile 5,000-mile-long border between the United States and Canada. And no, these aren't Canadians. I saw some people on the chat saying, stop those Canadians from coming in. No, we love the Canadians. It's not Canadians that are coming in legally, crossing at border crossings. No, it's Mexicans, mostly Mexicans, who can then travel visa free. That here's the rub, right? Under Trudeau's government.
I don't like the way you just said that. No, we love Canadians. It's Mexicans. Like we don't like Mexicans.
We like legal immigration. I didn't say we don't like Mexicans. I didn't say we don't like Mexicans.
No, but the way you just said that, you're like, it's not Canadians. We love Canadians.
I was making a joke. People in the chat were saying, yeah, keep those Canadians out. Meaning, no, that the invasion is coming from Canada.
Okay.
They're not
but
Canadians.
Do you see how that comes off?
I get the point, but my point is they're coming across legally. If Canadians are coming across the border legally at checks at border crossings and they're showing proper paperwork.
But let's turn our nose up at Canadians who are coming illegally too.
Yes. If you are an illegal Canadian coming across the border, I would have a problem with that as well.
Okay, good.
But that's not who's coming across.
All right. It has nothing to do with nationality. It has to do with legal status.
In part. But yeah, anyway, back to the, yes, they're mostly coming from Central and Southern America and Latin America. Yes.
I mean,
what? I'm making the point that they're coming across. If they're coming across legally, that's okay. We have legal processes for that. But if you're coming through the woods and you're coming illegally up from Latin America somehow, and you're coming into the United States illegally, and you're hiding using a coyote to come in the United States, that's a problem.
Yeah,
that's
like the dude who attacked Pelosi. Was an illegal Canadian.
Yes, he's an illegal Canadian.
He is.
Yes,
we don't like that guy.
We don't like that illegal Canadian.
As much as anybody else who's doing illegal activity and is an illegal person. Yes.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Don't come across illegally.
And beat up Nancy Pelosi.
And beat up Paul Pelosi with the hammer. Right. Don't do that.
Don't do that if you're an illegal Canadian. Don't do that. So what exactly
is the nationality doesn't matter. Don't do that, period.
Don't do that, period. Nationality doesn't matter at all. Right.
Right.
Don't hit Paul Pelosi with a hammer if you're American.
Don't come illegally and attack people with hammers.
I think we learned a lot here.
Especially Canadians.
Especially Canadians.
No, guys. Okay.
Mexicans.
I'm leaving.
You're fine.
I'm gonna go.
All right, let's get back to the story here because this is crazy. If you're a Mexican, then you don't need a visa right now under Trudeau's government. So you're allowed to travel visa free into Canada. This was part of the relaxing of the rules under the Trudeau government. So you're able to hop over the United States, get into Canada. And what a lot of these reports and whether it is being able to speak to these illegal immigrants saying, yeah, we don't have to deal with all of the hassle then at the southern border. We don't have to deal with barbed wire fences. We don't have to deal with the trauma of then, sleeping on floors at some sort of holding center if they're held. They don't have to deal with any of that. They get to go right into Canada and they can come right across the border and then they disappear into the United States. Many of them winding up, of course, in New York City in luxury hotels. and being put up and provided three meals a day with money, cell phones, a stipend that they can live. So, you know, it's sunny, right? It's beautiful for them to be able to do that. And where is this money coming from? These flights, though. So if you just have a little bit of money, you can spend $300 on a flight, hop over the United States and come into the United States, fly right into Canada, and then be bussed when you're inside the United States anywhere you want inside the U.S. Who's paying for this? NGOs. And like the IOM, of course, is paying for the buses and flights for illegal immigrants coming up through Panama and the like. So who exactly is funding these flights? We don't know. I hope we get to the bottom of that. I would love to know if the IOM is funding these flights also out of Mexico, straight up to Canada. Then they come across the border. That would be amazing, because then you would be paying for this. And of course, the United Nations wants this to happen. This is part of the United Nations program at the IOM to handle this migration effort out. They've doubled now the size of their contingency down in Panama through the Darien Gap, making sure that buses are provided, luxury buses, ferreting people right up to the United States, provided by the United Nations. And they're coming across the border, as we know, because U.S. taxpayers are footing the bill to pay for their second leg of their journey. According to Reuters, many of these illegal aliens then are put on chartered flights paid for by Customs and Border Protection and flown to Texas. So how is this now? They're coming across the border. They're then caught by Customs and Border Protection that you're paying for, paying their salaries, and then they're chartering flights, according to Reuters, and then ferreting these people down to Texas. Here, I'll just read from the Reuters report. Reuters learned of the flights from Thomas Cartwright, an advocate with the group Witness at the Border, who tracks U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement charter flights, which were used to move the migrants. Cartwright said, given the relatively high cost of the flights, it appeared that they were intended as a deterrence and to send a message. I want to ask all of you watching right now, does it seem like the deterrence is working? Like, how is this a deterrence? Can anyone weigh in and tell me in the chat room or here on this show how this would be a deterrence? That they would be flown out of this area, flown away from the Canadian border, and that would somehow send a message to them down in Mexico or other places?
I don't get it.
How would this be a deterrence? This is literally their plan, and U.S. taxpayers are footing the bill for this deterrence. Can anyone help me, Philip? Anyone? How is this a deterrence? I don't get it.
I got nothing.
Because the number has now spiked 700%, so...
Maybe they don't know what that word means.
That's possible. That is possible. So here's the front page of the New York Post, though, today, highlighting this growing problem of this Canadian break-in, as they call it. Over the past 24 hours, the Post is paying attention to the story, put together a really astonishing piece looking at the towns along the border with Canada, which are being inundated with illegal aliens. And you have one particular area where a lot of this is being focused in Vermont, specifically the border towns in Vermont. One resident using a simple trail camera that he's able to tap into his videos here on his iPad, and he uncovered a highly sophisticated illegal smuggling operation complete with a coyote smuggler who brings the men across, and then he goes back into Canada, and then he comes back a short time later, and he sees this guy on a regular basis on his trail cameras. He's like, yeah, there's Coyote Boy again, going back into Canada, bringing another group of like 5-10 guys back, all, you know, by the way, all military-age men. Like, no women and children in any of the footage or videos or photos that I've seen. And any of his trail cam footage, it's all men. And then they smuggle them back again. So these coyotes come over, and then they go back. They come down from just south of Montreal into the United States. And it's not surprising when most of the U.S.-Canada border looks like this. Not exactly a... I mean, it wouldn't be difficult to get across that. I wouldn't recommend like hopping on top of that. That would be the only deterrent. It would be like to do like a hop and then you land on that.
Well, that cautionary orange though, that's pretty intimidating. You're not supposed to go near that orange color.
It's very official looking.
Very official.
Watch out for that pyramid there.
Yeah, you might get a sticker in your sock from those weeds.
That's about it. Yeah, but that's what the U.S. border looks like there. The town of Swanton, Vermont, is one example. They have seen a massive influx of illegal aliens into this particular area of Vermont, which you can see how close it is to the Canadian border. And this area, which is interesting, in fact, 70% of the illegal entries are happening right now in this area of the United States border. It's very interesting why this particular section. It could be, of course, that Montreal has a lot to do with it. Like flights landing in Montreal, and it's a very close then drive to Swanton, which is only a 10-minute drive there to the border. So they're all congregating right there or near Lake Champlain. Here's what the New York Post has to say about this. Experts say migrants who make it to Mexico and have the money for a $350 one-way plane ticket from Mexico City or Cancun or Montreal or Toronto in Canada have caught on to the fact that they're less likely to be caught along the northern U.S. border. Border Patrol also appeared stunned at what's happening up there at levels that they've never seen before. They're like, hey, we might have like one guy every 20 years. This is really bizarre for us. Now it's happening to the tune of thousands of illegal immigrants. Watch.
Tonight, America's newest border crisis, this one up north.
It's definitely a huge issue.
We're on an exclusive trip with local police patrolling near New York's border with Canada.
This is unheard of up here. I mean, I've never seen anything like this.
The Clinton County Sheriff's Office tells us they're encountering migrants, mainly Mexicans, illegally crossing over the border from Canada at record levels.
So one local says he's been hunting these woods since childhood. And he said it's not uncommon for him to go an entire hunting season without seeing another human being. But now all of that has changed, he said, in the last 3 years. What has happened in the last 3 years in the United States to change all of this? We go hunting and never see another human being. And now he literally is up in his deer blind, or he's up in a tree like 15 feet up or whatever, up in the air. And he's just like routinely seeing illegal immigrants like coming through.
This is especially dangerous. You know, what the mainstream media will report on at the southern border is these trucks. They don't call it human trafficking, but they have these trucks of migrants that are being illegally smuggled past border checks. And then these migrants are kept inside of these humongous trucks with no food, no water, no insulation at all. So if this is happening from the north to the south, you can see how many of them would freeze to death in this right. kind of situation.
Right. I haven't thought about that. Yeah, I mean, they don't have the proper clothing. And as you can see here from, we'll just take a look at his trail cam videos here. I mean, they're not, this is during the summer, so they're coming in warm months in this video that he shared with the New York Post.
This was back in July. Okay. And there was like,
no.
Yeah, there was 8 or 9 in this group that day.
They just keep coming. And so, you know, just this is his back trail cameras. Here they come just all day, just triggering the trail cam movements and coming right through. And then, of course, you know, as you look, all military aged men. But this has been continuing right through the snow, right through the harsh winter. It doesn't matter. And, you know, the thing is, this is happening right under our noses. And the government is facilitating this to happen. And so they're being totally quiet about it. And I want to know, like, where are the White House press reporters? Where are they in asking these questions of Corinne Jean-Pierre or at, Department of Homeland Security? Where are the questions other than these congressional hearings where we have impeachment of Mayorkas? But why on a daily basis aren't we asking these questions about what's happening at the northern border, what's happening at the southern border, who's paying for these flights? Like, start asking some incisive questions.
And what were they told? When we just got a super chat, rightly saying they leave because their own countries are destabilized. Yes. Right. What were they told? What were the push factors to push them out of their home nations? That's just something that continues to be a lingering question.
Right. When you have Somali, when you have Yemen, when you have, Sudan. I mean, the list is endless right now. How many countries the United States and NATO have basically destabilized and caused this unrest in the first place, forcing them out of their countries and then forcing them into the United States so that they can join our military, I guess, for our forever wars that you and Neil Oliver were just talking about. Anyway, let me know in the comments below what you think about this.
Well, we have more news to get to. We're going to talk about censorship and the ways that it is industrialized or institutionalized inside of the United States government by unelected, powerful people who are deathly afraid that the New York Times and mainstream media will lose their power. Therefore, they won't be able to control you anymore. And then what? So they're desperately clinging to ways to control the narrative and terrified, and they're powerful. This is a dystopian story that is true.
Well, we always
I
say,
cannot stand it.
Well, we always say, right, desperate people do desperate things. And that's what you're seeing with these people.
Yeah.
Right?
Do we say that?
I mean,
that's the saying.
I say that a lot.
I don't know how much I say it.
I say that a lot. Also, I say, like, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. I say, like, a lot of, like, those are similar things I say a lot.
Yeah.
Desperate people do desperate things, and, like, breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
Mm-hmm. You say that. I yes, say honey, that. You do. Yes,
I say that. I say that a lot. What okay. else do I say? I'm trying to think of other phrases that I say a lot.
You know, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. Or something.
I'm a huge fan of malaphorism, so one of my favorite is, you buttered your bread, now sleep in it.
Is it malaphorism or malpropism? Malaphorism.
Oh, I don't know. I might have like just had a brain fart and said the wrong word. I don't know. Now I don't know.
Not
anyway,
on that.
We will talk about this censorship story. It's one of the most remarkable stories I've ever heard. And I mean, again, we were talking this weekend when we watched this interview, our jaws sort of hit the floor. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. We're going to go into this.
Even though we've been covering this for months and months, we know they censored Twitter during the pandemic. We yeah. know they censored social media around Hunter Biden. We know they censor things about the Ukrainian war. We are victims of that here on this show. We know this. But to see just how coordinated it is, it's not conspiracy theory. It is a conspiracy. And we're going to go through the proof of that. Plus, we're going to talk about the conspiracy to sell you a war around Alexei Navalny. I cannot stand it. One of the things I absolutely cannot stand over the weekend is politicians grandstanding about how sad they are and how they absolutely know that Putin killed Navalny. I can't stand it. This is something that I've been so worked up over the last, I would say, 48 hours. So we're going to break down all of those lies because I can't. I cannot.
My favorite, though, was Bono from U2 with that ridiculous
chanting. Over the weekend, there was a U2 concert where he asked the audience to chant Alexei Navalny.
His name.
Because.
Over and over.
He says Putin won't say his name, so we're going to say his name because he fought for freedom. He freaking didn't. He didn't. Okay, I can't. We're going
to
break this
down.
You're
here to watch a U2 concert. We want to take 10 minutes out for you to just say, everyone say it right now, Alexei Navalny. And it was like this weird, oh my God, it was so cringeworthy. I said, you got to turn that off. I can't watch that anymore.
It's terrible.
So yeah, that was worse than them forcing themselves on my iPhone like 10 years ago.
Oh my God. Yeah. Remember that?
People were pissed about that.
Suddenly a U2 album showed up like on your iPhone. You're like, I don't want this. Anyway. Well,
how would you like it if they forced Alexei Navalny chants on your iPhone?
Oh,
that would be one too far.
That's how you wake up in the morning. All right. So yes, we're going to get to that, all that and more. But first, I mean, I don't know if you've been watching what's happening right now with interest rates. There's this back and forth push and pull. What's going to happen? Is the Fed actually going to cut interest rates? Or are they not going to cut interest rates because their hands are tied right now when this whole reverse repo, whatever the heck, you know, stops in the next few weeks and all the stimulus dries up? Like, what is Jerome Powell going to actually do? Is CBS News going to do a whole new fawning report about Jerome Powell again and how he's a savior? Maybe he is, but we won't know because God knows it's up and down and your family's future is like tied to what the stock market does and what interest rates are and what the Fed does with printing fake money and driving the US dollar into the ground, for crying out loud. I mean, $34 trillion in debt is what the United States is right now. How is this sustainable? The answer is it's not. But what is sustainable is actually buying and investing in precious metals like silver and gold, which has been around for 4,000 to 5,000 years as a currency, as a way to preserve wealth. And our friends over at Lear Capital can actually help you get set up investing in precious metals. They're fantastic. You know, not your all of your savings. I mean, that's, you know, you can do whatever you want to do, but we're big proponents, Natalie and I, of having at least a portion of our family's savings in precious metals. Because, like I said, for 5,000 years, it has stood the test of time. Governments failing, wars, famines. It has stood the test of time. And right now, they are offering you a $3,600 gold report. It's a free gold report because analyst targets have gold hitting $3,600 an ounce. So go grab this free report, see what it's about. I mean, Bank of America is predicting $3,000 an ounce for gold, which is remarkable. And, you know, again, a portion of our savings in this stable commodity like gold and silver and real estate, frankly. To me, that's like the triangle, the triumvirate right there. So check out our friends over at Lear Capital. They love talking to our viewers on the phone. And when you call them, call their 800 number, tell them you heard about them from Redacted. They love talking to Redacted viewers. These guys are patriots, by the way. These guys have been in business for decades, thousands of five-star reviews, American to the core. These guys are a fantastic company. Call their 800 number, 1-800-613-3557 for your free guide. Or just go to LearRedacted.com, LearRedacted.com, and you could start buying gold and silver coins, have them sent to your house, or stored off-site in a secure facility. It's totally up to you. That's what we choose to do. We choose to have it stored, but you do you. LearRedacted.com is the place to go, LearRedacted.com.
A lot of people talking about that U2 and Bono, they're WEF puppets. Some people saying he was at Epstein. I had a lot of last night watching that ridiculous piece on YouTube. I posted on Twitter, actually on X, was like, are you guys on drugs for doing this? I couldn't stand it. And I had a lot of replies, people saying, no, they're just WEF stooges.
Of course they are.
I did not know this.
They're Klaus Schwab lovers. I mean, I think Klaus Schwab like hangs out at Bono's house on a regular basis.
Is this true?
Him and like Greta Thunberg. And I mean, can you imagine?
We're going to have to ask Whitney Webb about whether or not he's an Epstein, you know, related, all of that. So I didn't know anything about that. So I almost don't want to know and I don't care after this. I'm totally done with them.
Yeah.
But
if you weren't already, this would have pushed you over the edge for Bono, that's for sure, with his pink glasses. Okay, let's talk about this. Where is it here? Let's go. Well, we just got our clearest evidence yet that Americans are being censored and manipulated at the highest levels of government. One of the most disturbing and eye-opening interviews I've ever seen took place this weekend. I've had to watch it now three times. Four, if you count the amount of times that I've to clip sound bites for this show, really. We're going to show you a bunch of key moments from this interview that Tucker Carlson conducted with a man by the name of Michael Benz. Now, Benz worked at the State Department in the cyber division, and he's been blowing the whistle exactly on how America has essentially become ruled by the Pentagon. I'm going to say that again. America is ruled by the Pentagon, the Defense Department. As we've been warning you here on this show, the military-industrial complex, I mean, Eisenhower warned about it in his going away address. Too bad it was already too late when he said that at that time. But what they're doing is silencing, censoring Americans who they deem to be a threat of their plans for endless wars and the massive expansion of the military-industrial complex. They don't want you talking badly about their wars, turns out. And they want puppets in government like Joe Biden who will do their bidding, who will perpetuate these wars. That's how the machine continues to operate. What we learned in this interview is deeply disturbing, and it aligns with many of the stories of censorship that we've revealed here on this show. As Natalie just said a moment ago, we've talked about a lot of these things, certainly in the Twitter files and other pieces of censorship content that we've covered here on the show. It all aligns with that. But I think this is the biggest, most comprehensive education about all of this that we've heard. Benz sort of sets the stage by explaining how basically the United States government was blindsided by the power of social media, and how at first it was seen as a good thing, a way to prop up democracy, free speech. So they really championed social media. Watch.
In 2011, 2012, when you had this one by one, all of the adversary governments of the Obama administration, Egypt, Tunisia, all began to be toppled in Facebook revolutions and Twitter revolutions. And you had the State Department working very closely with the social media companies to be able to keep social media online during those periods. There was a famous phone call from Google's Jared Cohen to Twitter to not do their scheduled maintenance so that so that the preferred opposition group in Iran would be able to use Twitter to win that election. So it was free speech was an instrument of statecraft from the national security state to begin with. All of that architecture, all the NGOs, the relationships between the tech companies and the national security state had been long established for freedom.
So just think about that for a moment. The United States was going out of its way to make sure that these people had unfettered access to social media, to make sure that they were free from censorship, that they could tell the truth what was happening in their own country. I remember this explicitly. I was on the air at Fox and Friends on Fox News Channel during the Arab Spring, watching those amazing protests unfold. And one way we were able to get accurate information was from citizen journalists who were there on the ground as those governments were being toppled. So we were getting real-time information where newsrooms, like these legacy media, really couldn't get any information. So it enabled them in many ways to topple governments, to get their voices out, power to the people, essentially. But then Benz explains how the United States-backed coup in Ukraine changed everything. And so just some context here, of course, the United States, you know, Viktor Yanukovych, of course, was elected democratically. And then the United States, of course, comes in and foments a coup in Ukraine in 2014, right? And installs our own Western puppet government into Ukraine. Well, just so you understand what happened in Crimea at the time, well, then the ethnic Russians and the heavily ethnic Russian population in Crimea said, wait a second, we do not want this Western government representing us, this NATO-backed U.S. Western government that's anti-Russian and is pro-NATO, pro-U.S. They don't represent us. So we're going to join Russia. We're going to join the Russian Federation after the vote was held. And they voted overwhelmingly to become part of Russia. Because the West doesn't want you to know that part of the story. That's where Michael says everything went wrong for this plan. Now the social media, the power of social media actually led them to joining Russia. We can't have that happening on our watch.
Imagine what a big baby feels like when you can't control other people's countries and outcomes.
That you're seeing
that's
here
in Crimea. Exactly how Obama acted. Like, wait a minute. They chose for themselves.
They chose,
can't have this.
They chose to join Russia, not the puppet government that we just installed through our CIA.
That really backfired. Cannot have it.
So here's what Michael Benz says about that.
In 2014, after the coup in Ukraine, there was an unexpected counter coup where Crimea and the Donbass broke away. And they broke away with essentially a military backstop that NATO was highly unprepared for at the time. They had one last Hail Mary chance, which was the Crimea annexation vote on in 2014. And when the hearts and minds of the people of Crimea voted to join the Russian Federation, that was the last straw for the concept of free speech on the internet in the eyes of NATO.
That was it, right? And this is where stuff gets really crazy. Then comes Russiagate and the fake idea that Russia hacked our election and gave power to Trump. They built these spying tools, these censorship techniques to use against these foreign players. But after Russiagate collapsed and Trump fired all of these guys, they got together and essentially turned those tools away from the Russiagate story and from foreign adversaries towards the American people. Listen.
It was only after Russiagate died in July 2019 when Robert Mueller basically choked on the stand for 3 hours and revealed he had absolutely nothing after 2.5 years of investigation, that the foreign to domestic switcheroo took place, where they took all of this censorship architecture spanning DHS, the FBI, the CIA, the DOD, the DOJ, and then the thousands of government-funded NGO and private sector mercenary firms were all basically transited from a foreign from a foreign predicate, a Russian disinformation predicate, to a democracy predicate, by saying that disinformation is not just a threat when it comes from the Russians, it's actually an intrinsic threat to democracy itself.
Okay.
I mean, it's unbelievable. So now we're going to turn it, we're going to turn it on the American people, because they didn't see the size of the internet coming. They didn't see the power of the internet coming. They didn't see the power of social media coming. It's amazing to me. And I mean, I guess Bill Gates didn't see the internet either. Right?
Well, Microsoft, it's not so much that. It's that they didn't see the fact that they couldn't control it. They arrogantly thought that they could continue to control the narrative in the same way that they control the mainstream media. He talks about, do you have this in your clips, about CBS and the New York Times?
Oh, yeah.
And so the problem is not that people are speaking for themselves, because speaking out loud in a room is fine. But they'd been so conditioned to controlling the spin on all stories that they wanted through the mainstream media.
Well, and it's the power of the legacy media. It's the New York Times. It's the Washington Post. It's these newsrooms that they've infiltrated for years. Operation Mockingbird, the CIA control of these legacy media. And he explains how they've been fully their mouthpieces of the government. They have been. I mean, the history of the New York Times with the CIA is long and deep. So is CBS News, right? We know that. So when they're like, we're the most trusted name in news. No, you're not. You're mouthpieces of the intelligence state. You're mouthpieces of the government. So they didn't see the size of the internet coming, the scope of what social media would become. I guess at the time, you know, things like MySpace weren't even around. These little like piddly social media pages. Oh, someone has 20 followers. Big deal. Who cares about your little Facebook page and what you're doing on your father's birthday party or whatever? Who cares, right? They didn't foresee the size that some of these things could take on. Like, I mean, just look at the size of like Tucker's audience, right? Tens of millions of people. So that's a powerful, powerful block. And you had this moment where the elites were worried. They said, hey, what if the New York Times, which tells us all what to think, suddenly declines? This, for me, was one of the most eye-opening pieces of this entire interview. Watch this idea of this tabletop exercise. Like, what about the New York Times, which we control? What if suddenly no one's reading the New York Times anymore, and it's about the size of a small Facebook page? Watch.
The German Marshall Fund held a meeting in 2019. They held a million of these, frankly. But where a four-star general got up on the panel and said he posed the question, what happens to the U.S. military? What happens to the national security state when the New York Times is reduced to a medium-sized Facebook page? And he posed this thought experiment as an example of we've had these gatekeepers, we've had these bumper cars on democracy in the form of a century-old relationship with legacy media institutions.
So I'm blown away by that.
Is it bad that I got a little excited about the idea of
Did you see Tucker's face too? Because he's like, what is it? Because you have to think about the New York Times, the Washington Post, these publications. I mean, the LA Times is laying off hundreds of people, right? Because no one's reading them in the way that they were before. And you have to think that many of them were probably artificially propped up.
Yes.
Right? That I would love to know the full circulation numbers of the New York Times, right?
It's got to be scary for them for, you know, like shows like this where we don't have, you know, like, hey, we're bringing in, like a former Raytheon executive to talk about war in Ukraine. You know, it's like because we're not doing that. You know, it's like they can't control it. They can't control the narrative and even make it look like they're not controlling the narrative, you know?
Right.
So it's got to be frightening for
that
complex. But so, yeah.
Yeah, we won't do that. I don't want to name names, but there are certain legacy media that have offered us money and sponsorship, and we won't do it because we can't in good conscience promote something that we know tells lies.
I won't say the names, but we've had two legacy media companies reach out to us to sponsor our show. And I laughed out loud. I'm like, do you know who we are? I would never, ever allow you to be a sponsor on our show. Like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Two totally separate companies wanted to sponsor our show here at Redacted. Like, no way.
Companies that we have pointed out their lies before. So it would be disingenuous of us to take their money.
Anyway, we won't name names. But anyway, so then Trump wins the election, and then this happens.
When Trump won the election in 2016, everyone who worked at the State Department was expecting these promotions to the White House National Security Council under Hillary Clinton, who I should remind viewers, you know, was also Secretary of State under Obama, actually ran the State Department. But these folks were all expecting promotions on November 8th, 2016. and were unceremoniously put out of jobs by a guy who was a 20-to-1 underdog, according to the New York Times, the day of the election.
So then Trump wins, and when Trump won, all of these guys who worked for the Obama administration in the sanctions department, that's basically what they did, operated like sanctions within the State Department, took their skills then to Europe and really got the European Union, pressured them into a series of censorship tools where social media companies under the EU law would then be fined tens of millions of dollars if, say, someone posted something quote-unquote hateful on their platform. They then could be fined 10, 50, 20, 30, 40, $50 million per post because of the hate post that somebody on their platform made. So now these social media companies, through these European laws, were forced to change, and they could mass censor all of these posts in Europe. And that's what this group of Obama people did. And now then, once that happened, they were able to take, you know, shadow ban accounts, block tens of thousands of accounts, and then bring those things back to the United States. If they didn't want unfavorable topics being out there, 2020 election, masks, mandates, COVID, Dr. Fauci, posts about any of that, banned, blocked, hidden, suppressed, and censored. Listen.
And this was I call these weapons of mass deletion. These are essentially the ability to censor tens of millions of posts. With just a few lines of code, they created these COVID lexicons of what dissident groups were saying about mandates, about masks, about vaccines, about high-profile individuals like Tony Fauci. And then they plugged these into these essentially machine learning models to be able to have a constant world heat map of what everybody was saying about COVID. And whenever something started to trend that was bad for what the Pentagon wanted or was bad for what Tony Fauci wanted, they were able to take down tens of millions of posts. They did this in the 2020 election with mail-in ballots. It was the
same
groups.
I'm sorry. I just got to have to. There's so much here, and it's so shocking. So you're saying the Pentagon, our Pentagon, the U.S. Department of Defense, censored Americans during the 2020 election cycle?
Yes, they did this. The two most censored events in human history, I would argue, to date, are the 2020 election and the COVID-19 pandemic.
I mean,
two things you can still not freely talk about on YouTube.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, we're on Rumble. We're streaming live on Rumble. We can talk there about it. But literally in their terms of service to this day, you still can't talk about that on their platform. Isn't that amazing? Like, it's still there for anyone to go and read. Right now, you can read it if you want. Go read their community guidelines. See it for yourself. It's right there. So now they've used social media to comment about the election. If you use the social media to comment about the election, you could now be considered a cyber attack on America. That's literally what they're saying here. Listen.
They said mis, dis, and malinformation online are a form of cybersecurity attack. They are a cyber attack because they are happening online. And they said, well, actually, Russian disinformation is, we're actually protecting democracy and elections. We don't need a Russian predicate after Russiagate died. So just like that, you had this cybersecurity agency be able to legally make the argument that your tweets about mail-in ballots, if you undermine public faith and confidence in them as a legitimate form of voting, you were now conducting a cyber attack on U.S. critical infrastructure by articulating misinformation on Twitter. And just like that, now what they did then is they
complaining about election fraud is the same as taking down our power grid.
Yes, you could literally be on your toilet seat at 9:30 on a Thursday night and tweet, I think that mail-in ballots are illegitimate. And you were essentially then caught up in the crosshairs of the Department of Homeland Security classifying you as conducting a cyber attack on U.S. critical infrastructure because you were doing misinformation online in the cyber realm. And misinformation is a cyber attack on democracy when it undermines public faith and confidence in our democratic elections and our democratic institutions.
Unbelievable. got two more to show you here. Just two more. Someone in our chat, Phil DeGora, says, I'm a former U.S. Marine. This is not what I fought for or signed up for. Yeah. I think a lot of people are having this thought right now about what does it mean? What is the United States anymore?
And that we're paying for them to do this to us.
Right.
We're paying for them to torture us. Because this is a nightmare. Watching this is absolutely a nightmare. The fact that they classified the media as a tenet of the state. So if you are questioning the media, not only mail-in ballots, but if you're questioning the media, you could also be accused of being disruptive of government services. So they're basically admitting that the media is an arm of the government.
Right.
Yeah, it's a dystopian nightmare. Absolutely a dystopian nightmare. But I mean, you know, someone just in our chat pointed out that the Tucker Carlson interview with Vladimir Putin has how many billions of views now? That for them is a nightmare that they can't control, right? So
yeah, I mean, yeah, but now this is where we come back to desperate people do desperate things, right? Because now they're having, I mean, they tried to go after Tucker Carlson before his interview with Vladimir Putin. The NSA was spying on him, broke into his phone before, mm-hmm. I mean, what? He's a journalist. And you have the government is breaking into his phone before he goes to Moscow to interview president of Russia. Really? It's unbelievable to me. But this is now they're scared. So desperate people do desperate things. What are they going to do? That's what's really scary, because now people have, you know, and we have a platform like X for all of its imperfections. And I don't know all of its imperfections. This we're able to actually play this interview and talk about it because it was published on X. So anyway, they censored hundreds of millions of posts, and they did it 7 months before the election. They knew exactly that Biden was going to win the election. This is the most important part, I think, that maybe of this entire interview, is that they, you know, using mail-in ballots, they were trying to prevent people from talking about it. And they knew it 7 months ahead of time. Listen.
And mind you, they just on 15 platforms. So this is hundreds of millions of posts, which were all scanned and banned or throttled so that they could not be amplified, or they exist in a sort of limited state purgatory, or had these frictions affixed to them in the form of fact-checking labels where you couldn't actually click through to the thing, or you had to, it was an inconvenience to be able to share it. Now, they did this 7 months before the election. Because at the time, they were worried about the perceived legitimacy of a Biden victory in the case of a so-called red mirage, blue shift event. They knew the only way that Biden would be able to would win mathematically was through the disproportionate Democrat use of mail-in ballots. They knew there would be a crisis because it was going to look extremely weird if Trump looked like he won by seven states. And then 3 days later, it comes out actually the election switched. I mean, that would put the election crisis of the Bush-Gore election on a level of steroids that the national security state said, well, the public will not be prepared for. So what we need to do is we need to pre-censor the ability to even question the legitimacy. This took out.
Wait, may I ask you to pause right there?
Key influences,
so what you're saying is, what you're suggesting is, they knew the outcome of the election 7 months before it was held.
It looks very bad. Certainly what they did
Yes, Mike, it does look very bad.
It looks very bad. Yes, indeed. So they knew ahead of time what was going to happen, and they were then making sure to suppress any consternation about it online anywhere. They knew how this was going to unfold mm-hmm. 7 months ahead of time. They knew exactly how the election would play out.
Yes, that's very surprising.
I mean, what do we call this? You know, this is
illegal.
Yeah. And he points out it's the perfect crime, really, because the very people responsible for Trump's impeachment in the Russia hoax were behind this new form of censorship. I mean, it's unbelievable. The military industrial complex, the censorship industrial complex, one and the same. And, you know, he sort of levels it off at the end here to say that this is not a democracy. I mean, the U.S. is basically ruled by the military-industrial complex.
You're not describing democracy. I mean, you're describing a country in which democracy is impossible.
What I'm essentially describing is military rule.
Yeah, military rule. Let us know what you think about this in the comments below. I think it's one of the most disturbing interviews. We'll link it up in the description. I would encourage all of you to go watch it while it's available on YouTube. I can't believe that it's still available on YouTube, that interview. I think it just would be, I guess if you're YouTube, you probably look at that video, you're like, oh my God, there's a lot of things that we don't allow said in our terms of service. But if we take this video down, we at YouTube are going to look really stupid.
Yeah.
We're going to be literally censoring a video about censorship.
Which they do all the time.
I know, but this
happily
is the size.
To us.
They'll probably still do it. Probably still do it after it's run its advertising course. And right, then they'll pull it.
They make their money on it. Yeah. Right. Unbelievable here. And I think Mike, we've invited Mike on the show. I want to dive more deeply into some of these specific topics here, pull threads a little bit more closely here and ask some more, deeper dive questions on some key points that he pointed out when this hour long interview with Tucker. So bravo to them for doing this interview. Again, one of the most disturbing and thoughtful interviews I've ever seen. So yeah. I encourage all of you to go and watch it.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about Alexei Navalny coming up and how the U.S. and the EU and the U.K., all politicians shedding crocodile tears, but ready to use his wife to continue his cause. We're going to break down all of the lies that we've been told about Alexei Navalny for the last 5 years, at least, so that when you see them spew more bullshit, you can say, okay, where is the proof? Did that happen? Because we've been lied to about Alexei Navalny all the live long day, and we're done with that. Does that mean that we know how he died? No, we don't know that yet, but we're going to talk about what we do know. We're going to get to that in a second. But first, we want to tell you about our friends over at The Wellness Company, because if the year 2020 comes back around and we're back in lockdowns, I know that sounds ridiculous, right? But just over the weekend, Dr. Tedros from the World Health Organization said, oh no, disease X is coming. We need to be prepared. It's a placeholder, is what he called it. A placeholder for what I intend to do to you, which is stay in your house, take away your freedoms. That's what the World Health Organization wants to do. This is not conspiracy theory. This is true. Well, what you can do is make yourself prepared with the wellness kit. You can get their medical emergency kit. You can avoid hospital wait times, avoid the cost of a doctor's visit or calling an ambulance, avoid getting caught unexpectedly when traveling without a healthcare plan. The Wellness Company's medical emergency kit includes 8 life-saving medications, including amoxicillin, Z-Pak, all the things that you need to keep on hand. You never know why. Every scenario is covered. So you can check it out right now. It always pays to be prepared. You can go to twc.health/redacted and get your medical emergency kit right now. That's twc.health/redacted. And if you use the code redacted, you get 10% off at checkout. So don't wait until you need it. Take back control of your health today. Keep this in your in case of emergency place in your house. That's the Wellness Company's medical emergency kit, and we thank them so much for their support of this show.
Yeah, they got ivermectin in there too, so good for them.
Yeah. I thought we weren't supposed to say that on. We can say that now?
Screw them. Who cares?
Okay. All right. Well, yes.
I mean, it exists. It's a real thing.
If you have animals or people, or look it up yourself.
Yeah, it's in there. It's in the kit. It's in the wellness kit.
There are things you can say. Yeah, there are things you can say. There are things you cannot say about them. And, right. And we didn't say, Clayton didn't say anything about
okay.
it.
Okay.
On these censorship platforms, it exists.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool, cool. All right. Before we get to our last story, I want to say ha ha about all the Where's Waldo jokes about my shirt.
People are like,
I see it
Natalie?
Loud and clear.
Where's Waldo?
That's funny. It's like the Beetlejuice one we had before we went on break for Clayton. I like it. It's good. I'm down with it. I'm laughing with you.
I think, you should see this outfit from head to toe. She looks beautiful. And I told you as much earlier today.
That's nice of you to say.
I told you
it's
that
a skirt. Show you.
It's a skirt.
It's a skirt.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't know.
Yeah. Just
you
a hint.
You want to see my knee?
So we should set up. Okay, so this next story here, some of you may have had a chance to see over the weekend.
Wait, I want to say one more thing before we, just one more housekeeping bit. Thank you for the super chat for Philip. That was nice. Somebody said, here's $5 for a cup of coffee for Philip. And Philip will have that cup of coffee. We will. So help me God.
I will.
Yeah.
It will be an iced cold brew for sure.
Okay. All right. Black. So I just wanted to let you know. Thank you so much. That's really sweet. I appreciate Philip very much, too. Because over the weekend, news broke that Alexei Navalny died in a Russian prison of unforeseen circumstances. Now, when this happened, right on cue, all Western politicians started shedding crocodile tears about how Alexei Navalny gave up his freedom. There's lie number one. About how Alexei Navalny fought for freedom for everybody. That's lie number two. About how he had been poisoned and politically persecuted by Putin himself. That's lie number three. And I can prove it. And I absolutely could not stand it. So I decided to film the video that I'm about to show you from our vacation where we were traveling, because I just couldn't stand watching people lie about this story and be manipulated into war. Philip, who is going to receive this cup of coffee from that super chat, thank you so much, said, yeah, I'm free. I'll edit your video. So Clayton set up the camera. I sat down with my notes and I filmed what you're about to see. Now, this was filmed Friday night in a hotel room, just with me and my notes. I want to give you the update on where that story is currently, because as I start to go through these lies, now there are four main lies that I break down. Was Alexei Navalny a hero? Was he poisoned by the Russian government? Was he, politically persecuted? And was he Putin's main opponent in Russia? Now, the media now is saying because he was so important to Russians, which is not true, his wife is going to pick up the cause now. She will be their new cause de celeb. She says, I'm not afraid. I'm going to become the politician that Russians want of me. Okay. Alexei Navalny had never more than 4% support inside of Russia. I do not think people are going to be rushing to support his wife either, but she's a beautiful lady. She looks nice on camera. The West will be using her. She already today says she thinks that he was poisoned with Novichok. Please hold for what I'm going to teach you about Novichok if you don't already know. So I'm excited for you to see this piece because I don't know why. This one really gets to me more than most because of the blatant lies and the banking on your ignorance to repeat this Putin is a madman. He poisons his political opponents. He persecuted him politically. So watch for yourself. Let us know what you think. And please share this video with anyone you think is shedding inappropriate crocodile tears for this news. Thank you so much for watching. And we're going to end the show with this. So again, we're going to let you see what we filmed on Friday. And we welcome your comments. American politicians and the media is mourning the death of racist and xenophobe Alexei Navalny as a hero and a victim of Vladimir Putin and his regime. Now, they're doing this to sell you a war with Russia, but if you look into who this guy truly is and how little we know about what happened to him, you will not accept this as a reason for any war. Now, Alexei Navalny died in prison today after reportedly suffering from a blood clot. The Federal Penitentiary Service of Russia reported that he fell ill after taking a walk. He lost consciousness, and medical staff did try to resuscitate him, but were unable. President Biden used the occasion for a live press conference in rare form. Every politician is ringing in with outrage, saying this shows that Putin is a madman, Russia is evil. Oh, but he was a political prisoner, the West says. He was poisoned by the Russians. He was Putin's biggest threat. None of this is true. I'm going to tell you what we do know about Alexei Navalny before he became this media darling, because it was easy to use it as a hit to Russia and Putin. Let's tackle just these four questions. Number one, was he really a hero worth championing? Number two, was he poisoned specifically by the Russian government? Number three, was he wrongfully imprisoned? And number four, was he actually Putin's main opponent? A lot of this comes from Jacques Bode's great book, The Navalny Case, Conspiracy to Serve Foreign Policy. So it's a great book. I'm going to recommend that you read it for yourself. But let's start with the first question, was he a hero? Even the West knows that he wasn't. Here's a Salon.com article from as far back as 2017 calling him no progressive hero. He was basically, they said, the Russian equivalent of a white nationalist. He hated immigrants. They called him the Russian Trump. They said that liberals, well, if they studied, which they don't, would hate him even more than Steve Bannon. Here are a couple things. They say he's anti-immigrant, especially when it comes from newcomers from Central Asia. They say that Putin, the people who support him, say that Putin is responsible for the destruction of Russia for allowing immigration. He has played a role in skinhead marches. He has the sympathies of other extremists. I love this tweet. It says, always a bummer for Westerners when they first learn about Navalny's anti-immigrant xenophobia and his role in Moscow's skinhead marches. Does the West know this? Do they care? All of this praise, is this the equivalent of hosting a Nazi in Canadian Parliament, I wonder? So you decide. These are, of course, protected beliefs. If you want to be a racist, go ahead. But it's a free country. You're allowed to be. But at least you should know when you're supporting a racist, right? Do you know that if you're supporting Navalny? Okay, question number two. Was he poisoned by the Russian government for being in opposition to Vladimir Putin? Well, the alleged poisoning happened on a flight from Tomsk to Moscow. His entourage said at first that it happened with tea, but the tea was brought to him by his own colleagues. There was another weird story about underwear. When no one could corroborate that later, they said it was from water bottles from the hotel. They said that they actually took these bottles to Germany for analysis, but airport security footage shows that the luggage was checked. There was never any bottles, and the German government never said that they looked through any bottles, so that was weird. And in fact, his own colleagues later retracted the water bottle story. Now, about that poisoning, they claim it was Novichok, which means little one, in Russia. Strangely enough, reports are that Novichok is a combat toxicant that remained at the experimental stage and was never actually adopted by the USSR or Russia. They noted that its high toxicity made it difficult to handle on the battlefield, meaning if they tried to poison people with it, they'd get hurt themselves. So the Soviets abandoned it, and the facilities were then converted to produce chemicals for civilian use in 1987. Okay, but guess who does have Novichok? This is interesting, and guess where it's kept? According to sources, Novichok has been found in several NATO countries, including Germany, the United States, Great Britain, Czechoslovakia, and Sweden, and has been used for the purpose of research and the development of antidotes. As early as 1990s, the United States has filed nearly 140 patents on chemical weapons of this type. And as early as 1998, the American Chemical Weapons Laboratory in Edgewood synthesized Novichok. And according to this former FSB director, a small stockpile of Novichok existed in Ukraine. Huh. Okay, but suppose someone in Russia did get their hands on some Novichok and used it to poison Alexei Navalny. Well, this is known as an organophosphorus toxin, which means it disrupts the functioning of the muscles, and it's irreversible. You seize up, and then you can't reverse that, basically. Doctors, if they suspect that anyone has been poisoned with it, they have to wear full protective gear and masks. Funny, because no one who ever treated Navalny was in that gear. Not on the plane, not in the hospital, not in the ambulance. That's weird, right? Why is that? In fact, when he was later flown to Germany for treatment, we're going to get to why in a second, the German government later said, why did we put our people at risk if he was exposed to Novichok? And they were upset about it. Now, why did he go to Germany? It's weird, because if you're going to go to the trouble to poison him, if you're the Russian government, why then do you let him leave for Germany? Why do you poison someone and then let them go? Well, here's why. It's because this NGO group demanded that he be treated in Berlin. They chartered a plane, and the plane took off a day later. Thus, in the late afternoon, at least one German doctor was at his bedside in Russia while arrangements for his transfer were made. On the evening of the 21st, after the personal intervention of Vladimir Putin, the Russian authorities gave their agreement for him to be treated in Germany. Why would Putin do that? Why do you poison someone and then say, okay, we'll break the rules and let him leave to Germany? Why do that? That's weird, right? especially considering that he was under parole, which forbid him to leave the Russian territory, but Putin allowed it. Okay. Now, no one on that flight was wearing any protective gear. None. Despite any suspicions of Novichok poisoning, which actually the doctors in Russia never suspected. They were just trying to figure out what was wrong with him. It wasn't until he got to Germany that they started to use the language of Novichok poisoning. Now, while he was in Germany, these reports became highly classified. If you look through them, the various reports by the Charité Hospital, which is in Germany, the OPCW by Germany, Sweden, or France, all based on blood samples, which we're going to look at in a second, and none of them confirms the mode of poisoning, nor does it refer to the bottles or the underwear. And this was confirmed later in German parliament. The analysis carried out by all of these Western laboratories remain classified and have not been published or communicated to Russia despite their request. Now, the hospital in Germany did issue a press release saying that the analysis indicated intoxication by a substance, but they didn't say what. Later, a Swedish analysis said this: the presence of XXXX was confirmed in the patient's blood. That's redacted. Well, that's weird. If they want us to think that it's Novichok so much and they know what's there, why redact it from us when you're so busy trying to tell us that he's been poisoned with this? This point about how the Swedish government does the bidding of the U.S. government, their paymasters over Julian Assange, is worth noting as well. Now, later, the medical journal The Lancet published this article that did have Navalny's blood work. They concluded as well that it was Novichok, but they also published his blood work, and it showed the following. If you read this over, you can tell that Navalny's blood work had the following: albumin, which suggests a liver problem, high values of this LDH, suggesting metabolic disorder, often observed with cancerous tumors, values of amylase and lipase suggest pancreatitis, which had been mentioned about him in the past, these other values suggesting a bacterial infection, another drug often used to treat Parkinson's disease. Did he have Parkinson's disease? Lithium used to treat bipolar disorder and depression. And these other things were present, which shows us that the man who died this week in a Russian prison was not otherwise a healthy man, even before this alleged poisoning. So will we ever know if he was actually poisoned, if it was actually the Russian government, what was there, who put it there? We have so little evidence about this, despite the fact that the Western press has just run away with this completely. He was absolutely poisoned with this nerve agent, they say. What we do know is that he gets better in about the span of a month. He's released by the end of September, and his doctors say he's fine in October. That gets us to our third question then, because he later gets imprisoned in Russia. Was he wrongfully imprisoned? Well, Navalny was indicted on corruption charges, and he was only ever given a parole sentence for the same thing which other people do get jail time for. The fact that he was given a lenient sentence for that corruption charge and then violated his bail was never reported in the Western press, despite the fact here it says that he had already violated this rule six times in 2020 before this alleged poisoning, twice in January, once in February, March, July, and August, but the Russian authorities were lenient with him. So not only had he had a lenient sentence for this indictment, he had been allowed to continue to just fly in the face of that parole conditions and not uphold it. Now, he violated this several times, not because he was laid up in a hospital in Germany. This was not why he then went on to violate it again. He was discharged from the hospital. He ignored his parole to go on tour in Europe and go on vacation. Let's take a look at his schedule. I want to point out, because this book is translated from French, sometimes it says her when we mean him for Navalny. The obligation to report was suspended by Russian authorities while he was in the hospital. On the other hand, the report of the doctors in the hospital say that he was basically done with his symptoms in October. After leaving the hospital, again, he had special permission to leave and then he was supposed to go back because he was on parole. He did not. He went to Basel. He gave an interview with the German media. Then he went on to southern Germany and spent a few days getting back into shape. Then in November, he went on a teleconference to Europe parliamentarians, to demand sanctions against Russia. Then later, he flew to the Canary Islands for a seaside holiday, which he decided to take unexpectedly against the advice of his bodyguards. Then he took part in his film until January before leaving for Russia on January 17th. Everything seems to show that Navalny would have been able to return to Russia to fulfill his obligations and that our media have played with the facts. On December 28th, in fact, the prison authorities sent him and his lawyers and his press secretary a warning, but he ignored it. Therefore, Russian prison authorities could hardly ignore this new highly publicized offense. So he's continuously violating his bail, and he's doing a media tour and taking fancy vacations and basically showing off about it. So it says here that they just, at this point, they just couldn't ignore this anymore, and they revoked his suspended sentence. He probably, it says, was hoping to benefit once again from the clemency of the authorities, but with broadcasting his film and calls for sanctions against Russia, that was probably naive on his part. He had just pushed it too far. Now, this is when the West jumps in and says Putin is persecuting his enemies. Russia is persecuting opposition politicians. You know the rest. But okay, to the last question. Is he actually Putin's main opponent? He is not. Putin's main opponent is the Communist Party, not the extremists who follow Navalny. In fact, Alexei Navalny was hardly popular in Russia. He had about 3% political support. Most people only know him because he was good on Instagram, but people outside of urban centers didn't much know him. In fact, if you look at this poll, it shows his approval ratings of his activities go down after this alleged poisoning. Now, these are not people who would vote for him. This is just people's impression of him because, again, his actual political support has been estimated at about 2-4%. But he loses a percentage after he claims to have been poisoned. And in fact, many report that when Russians see the Western press champion someone, they get suspicious that that person is a Western puppet. And there is a lot of evidence that Alexei Navalny was indeed a Western puppet and supported by American government NGOs and the CIA. There's a lot of proof there. We'll save that for another video. Putin, again, his main opponent is the Communist Party, certainly not the extremists who followed Alexei Navalny. And Putin has said himself that if he wanted to poison Alexei Navalny, he would not have failed. He said this in December of 2020. He said, why would we even bother with that? And if I wanted him poisoned, he would be dead. Now, does that mean then that Vladimir Putin is good to his enemies? Does that mean Alexei Navalny had it easy in prison? Does that mean he was well treated? We don't know. We absolutely should want answers to those questions. I'll tell you what, though, I do not want answers to those questions from any NATO source or any NATO ally, not after the reports I've showed you about his alleged poisoning and how they played politics with those medical reports. So we should want an answer, but who do we trust for that answer? I don't know. Let me know what you think. So what is the takeaway from this death? Obviously, any death is tragic. People who loved Alexei Navalny did not get to say goodbye while he was in prison. My point here is not that this is a good thing. Clearly, it's not. My point here is that the West has used this story and manipulated you into thinking this person is a hero in order to sell you a lie and a war with Russia. My view on it is absolutely there should not be a war with Russia over this person and this story, and you should reject these media narratives. Let me know what you think. Thank you so much for watching this redacted special report. And if you have any comments, I would love to hear them. And like and share this video.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.